You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC. I'm Carrie Nolan, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. As housing foreclosures continue to sweep across the country, two New York writers have traveled to two very different locations to research the crisis. Alex Kotlowitz's cover story, All Boarded Up, for the March 8th issue of the New York Times Magazine, delves into Cleveland's debacle. And George Packer, writing for the February 9th issue of the New Yorker, covers Florida's foreclosure epidemic in his article, The Ponzi State. I'm pleased to welcome Mr. Kotlowitz and Mr. Packer to the show today. Hello, gentlemen.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, George.
Hi, Alex. Nice to meet you on air, at least.
Likewise.
Let's start with you, George. Since we've just seen Bernie Madoff's sentence for perhaps history's largest Ponzi scheme, what was it about Florida's foreclosure disaster that led you to the title, The Ponzi State?
It was a phrase I heard from a historian in St. Petersburg, Florida, Gary Marmino, who said you could compare Florida to a Ponzi scheme in the sense that it's prosperity has always depended on 1,000 people a day moving there. And I will be okay as long as 1,000 people keep coming after me, which is a bit like an investment scheme where you pay off your current investors with the promise of new investors. Mm-hmm. And what's happened in Florida is that the 1,000 people a day, which was the average throughout most of the past decade, stopped coming. It's almost zero now. And as a result, the Ponzi scheme in Florida has collapsed.
Well, I know in your article you spoke to a moving company person who said that they were moving more people out of Florida than were coming in.
That's what the state treasurer, Alex Sink, told me she heard from Allied Van Lines at a Chamber of Commerce meeting. Yeah, and that's a disastrous sign for Florida. That's like, you know, Alaska finding out that there's no more salmon. That's like, you know, Cleveland finding out that steel production has plummeted. So it's people and tourism and retirement are the basis of the Florida economy and the real estate and construction industries that follow those. And that's what has dried up.
Alex, you start your article with the sentence, Tony Brancatelli, a Cleveland City councilman, yearns for signs that normal life still exists in his ward. Why did you choose him as the focus of your article?
Well, you know, I wanted to find a way to, in some ways, what George did in Florida, which is to figure out a way to look at what's going on the ground. I mean, we've heard so much about, you know, the policy questions and sort of what happened, and I think it's now sort of important to take measure of the impact of this. I'd say the aftermath, but I don't think we've seen the end of this. And so Tony Brancatelli is somebody, as a city councilman, who's got to deal with this on a daily basis. He, in his ward, Slavic Village, he has two foreclosures a day now. And Tony is somebody who, you know, unlike Florida, which was seeing these boom years, Cleveland, which, as George alluded to, had seen steep decline after the loss of the steel industry and was finding its footing again, finding an equilibrium in the 1990s. They were building new homes. They were, you know, the construction of these new stadiums downtown, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and then wham, they got hit by this foreclosures. They got hit early and they got hit hard. And somebody like Tony Brancatelli's been at this now for a long enough time that I felt there was a lot we could learn from what he was tangling with.
How many foreclosures have there been in Cleveland? Do we have numbers on that?
Well, for the last two years, there have been 10,000 foreclosures. But to give it some perspective, I think the more important number to look at in Cleveland, and for me, what was most staggering, is you go into that city, and it really much of it is in ruins, and the number of vacant homes in that city are somewhere between 10,000 to 15,000. One of every 13 houses in that city are vacant and abandoned, mostly because of foreclosures.
Would it be safe to say that not any neighborhood in Cleveland has been spared?
Right. I think so. Absolutely. In fact, the judge that I write about, who lives on this beautiful street of these old Victorians and colonials, I mean, he's had three foreclosures on his street. And in fact, he has made an effort with some of his neighbors to try to keep one of the homes from getting vandalized. And what they've done is they've turned on the electricity. He parks his car in the parking spot there, so it looks like somebody's still there. I mean, there's not a neighborhood in Cleveland that hasn't been hit.
George, let's talk a little bit about Florida and what has happened there. Do we have numbers on those homes, or is it too wide a swath of real estate to compare against Cleveland?
I don't have raw numbers on foreclosures in Florida. What I can tell you is that in some parts of Florida, the foreclosure rate is over 10%, which is really high. And Fort Myers, which is south of Tampa Bay, has the highest foreclosure rate in
Why?
The country, Fort Myers, Cape Coral. I think because speculation was rampant there. A realtor told me that two-thirds or three-quarters of his business was with speculators who were from other states or other countries who were buying properties strictly to watch their value increase and then to flip them, as they say, to turn a quick profit on them. Sometimes these properties were sold even before they were closed on. The ideal situation was for the speculator not to have to go through closing, but for someone else to do the closing. That's how fast it was happening.
Wow.
Some very ordinary people, secretaries, car dealers, construction workers, were buying 6, 7, 8 properties and flipping them. It was like sort of casual day trading for Americans in other places.
Well, you talk in your article about bank tellers who had 8 or 10 investment properties at a time when they were only making about $30,000 a year.
Or who had only their own property but whose mortgage was worth at least 10 times their salary and was no interest up at the beginning and no money down and a low interest rate at the beginning. And then after a few years, the interest rate suddenly kicked up and the bubble burst. And that's the other reason why Fort Myers and Cape Coral have this high rate, because so many people took out these subprime loans. And when the housing market collapsed, and it happened rather quickly between 2006 and 2007. Florida was really ahead of the country in suffering the results of the housing bust. These people suddenly were underwater. Their house was worth less than their mortgage, and the foreclosure can't be far behind, especially when you've just lost your job in the construction industry.
I'm Carrie Nolan, sitting in today for Leonard Lopate. We're talking with Alex Kotlowitz, who wrote the cover story All Boarded Up for the March 8th issue of the New York Times Magazine. And George Packer is with me with his thoughts on his article from the February 9th issue of the New Yorker. George, I want to go into another part of your article that where you write about ghost subdivisions as opposed to ghost towns. Can you describe for us what those communities look like?
Yeah, in this sense, I think Alex and I were looking at the same problem from sharply different angles. And the two articles together show you how vast this problem is, how many Americans it touches. In counties around Tampa, Hillsborough County, Pasco County, Pinellas County, the past decade saw a huge boom in subdivisions going up, which means a community, whether gated or not, planned by a developer across a sandy field that no longer had any palmettos and orange groves, which it once had, roads paved where there had been no roads, given pretentious names like Pumpkin Ridge Road. The subdivisions all had these sort of faux British names like Saddle Ridge Estates and the Hammocks at Kingsway.
Right.
And two-story stucco houses built and waiting for people to come. And people began to come because the lure was low property taxes in these suburban counties. Pretty affordable houses. I mean, $230,000, $240,000 for three bedrooms, two stories. And so these were working families. These were not retirees. These were not speculators. These were working families who wanted to get out of the city and didn't want to pay high property taxes. And so they began to fill up, and then the housing market, in my image, collapsed like Wile E. Coyote looking down and suddenly falling out of thin air. And people began to lose their homes. And by December, when I took a driving tour around Pasco County, the subdivisions weren't – I wouldn't say they were empty, but some streets had no sign of human life. They were for sale signs everywhere. They were these inflatable Christmas figures that had collapsed on the lawn.
Mm-hmm.
And it was as if – it was a kind of perfect community with the lawn still trimmed. This was not, you know, a community that had gone to seed yet.
Right.
Because I think some people were keeping up their neighbor's property and, as Alex said, parking their car in their neighbor's driveway to make it look like someone was home. So it had a kind of perfect look in this aquamarine light of Florida, but there were no people or almost no people. And when I began knocking on doors, it was very hard to find anyone. And there were newspapers piled up in some at some front doors and a few lawns beginning to get a little bit ragged and no furniture inside. So it had a depopulated look that was in many ways, to me, creepier than the more familiar look of a boarded-up house in the inner city, because this was sort of the sheen of prosperity, of American suburban prosperity, without any of the human content.
Well, let's look on the urban side of that coin. Alex, you write of half the homes on a city street being boarded up or looted. Let's talk a little bit about what those neighborhoods are like.
Right. Well, you know, one of the things that happens in Cleveland, especially when scrap prices were high, is that as soon as a house would go through share sale, vandals, scavengers would immediately enter the house and they would take a hammer or sledgehammer to the walls and begin to rip out the copper pipes and the electrical wires. They'd take the hot water heaters and the furnace. They'd peel off the aluminum siding from the outside. In fact, now they're actually taking the cement slabs that make up the front steps. I mean, it's literally as if the city has had its legs knocked out from under it. So what happens at these houses, which may not have been, you know, unlike the houses in Florida that George writes about, these are old homes that, you know, maybe needed work, and literally within a matter of a day or two, they're completely stripped of all their innards.
It's an awfully resonant image when you think about it.
Yeah, well, it's as if a city has had its skin stripped away, and so you have these houses that sit there for months upon months, and the city will go and board them up. Squatters will come, they'll rip off the boards, and I think one of the things the two things for me that was most astonishing was not only the number of vacant homes, but the number of homes that were completely open, just wide open. You could just walk in there. And as a result, they have squatters. They've had a high number of fires. Tony Brancatelli and his ward last year had 65 fires in vacant houses. I think for me, the most astonishing thing was in some ways not the people who left, but the people who have remained behind. I mean, who are trying to somehow manage amidst all this.
I want to take a little bit of time and talk about that after we come back from our break. I'm Carrie Nolan, sitting in for Leonard Lope today on WNYC. And we're talking with Alex Kotlowitz and George Packer. They have written each very interesting, very scary articles in many ways about the housing crisis from two different perspectives. Alex Kotlowitz writing in the Times Magazine last week about Cleveland, and George Packer in last month's New Yorker about the Florida foreclosure epidemic. I'm going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back to continue our conversation. This is WNYC New York. Later on in the show, Mary Stuart Masterson on making her directorial debut with The Cake Eaters. Plus, feeling anxious that it's Friday the 13th? Well, find out why on this week's Please Explain. It's all about superstition. I'm Carrie Nolan, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.
WNYC is supported by Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island, offering summer programs to help high school students prepare for college success. Summer at Brown 2009 pre-college programs are now online and open for registration at brown.edu/summer. The Manhattan Chamber of Commerce Green Business Committee, presenting the Greener New York Summit, Who's Got the Answers, March 27th, 8 until noon at Con Edison, 4 Irving Place at 14th Street. Registration at 212-473-7805 or manhattancc.org. Parlance Chamber Concerts, presenting jazz guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli, Howard Alden, and Frank Vignola on Sunday, March 15th at 4 p.m. at Westside Presbyterian Church in Ridgewood, New Jersey. More at WNYC.org.
I'm John Hockenberry from The Takeaway. For a week, we talked about your new American dream.
And I believe the American dream is to follow after the footsteps of my grandfather, my father, to grow into somebody who's strong enough to help my country and to help somebody else grow into somebody stronger.
What'll it be next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International, and WNYC? Join us every weekday morning.
This is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Carrie Nolan sitting in for Leonard, and we're talking with Alex Kotlowitz and George Packer. They have each written very interesting articles about the foreclosure crisis in the country. Alex is taking a look at Cleveland and George taking a look at Florida. We were talking with Alex before the break, and Alex, you we're discussing what happens to these abandoned homes, and the innards, as you say, get stripped, all the metal and the copper pipe. And all the guts of the homes are just taken apart. How are people getting by who still live among these abandoned houses?
Right. I mean, that's the tough part. I think, and that's what the sort of challenge for Tony Brancatelli is, sort of how you manage. And there's this, and you had mentioned earlier about how Tony looks for these kind of small morsels of hope, as far as signs of normalcy in his. In his city. And there's this one point when Tony and I were driving through his ward, we passed this this beer and wine store. I mean, we've seen these many times in neighborhoods. You know, it's kind of run down, and Tony was just telling me how much he appreciated having it there. It was right in the smack in the middle of a residential block. And it turns out when that store had been purchased by a gentleman, Jerome Jackson, Tony went up to him, this is a few years back, and said, "Hey, Jerome, you got to know I'm going to challenge your liquor license. I don't like the idea of having a store like this in this neighborhood." And well, Jerome moved in. He bought a foreclosed home down the block for his brother to live in. He brought the abandoned home next to his store and tore it down. And it became clear that not only was Jerome committed to staying there, but he was kind of keeping a watchful eye on things. And so Tony has kind of changed his tune now, and he wants Jerome Jackson to stay there in that store. And, in fact, is now afraid that somehow Jerome Jackson is going to end up leaving. And that's the real challenge, is how do you hold on to those people? I think it's in some ways what George writes about it all as well, is that Cleveland's problem now is people are leaving the city and they're not coming back in. They're not filling in these houses. And so that's part of the challenge for the city. I mean, the other challenge for them is how do you maintain these distressed and vacant homes? How do you make sure that the owners, most of whom are lenders and banks, are held accountable?
I want to open this question up to both of you. Why is it so hard for homeowners to just sit down with their banks and renegotiate these mortgage payments? It seems that, you know, everyone would sort of benefit from that.
Well, I think in the couple of cases I heard about or interviewed in Fort Myers, Cape Coral, the bank just wasn't interested in doing that. Couple of families that I talked to had tried, had not been able even to get a phone call return. And I think this was because of the short-sightedness of the banks. They didn't want to see the package that they negotiated renegotiated in a way that would reduce, you know, interest rates for the short term or even suspend paying principal for a while. They were greedy. And they thought that at the beginning of this crisis that they'd be able to find buyers for these houses once they foreclosed on them. And it's only been in the last few months, and I think under some pressure from the government, that the banks have begun to realize that it's not only bad to have people lose their houses, but it's bad for banks to have thousands of foreclosed properties on their hands.
Right. I mean, what happens is these banks end up, rather than having a property where somebody's living in it and still maintaining it, they end up with these properties that end up getting vandalized and sit for months, sometimes even years. And it's interesting, the FDIC, when they took over the IndyMac portfolio, I mean, they, you know, when they were had access to all this privileged information, I mean, they were able to assess that a bank actually would save $50,000 on average per house if they didn't foreclose on it, if they were able to maintain somebody in that property who would keep it up, knowing that at some point property right prices would hopefully will someday rise again. And it had, I mean, George is right. I mean, it was terribly short-sighted on the parts of banks and lenders.
You know, Alex, I wanted to ask you something about your piece, because in Florida there were two different ways in which this foreclosure crisis happened. One was there was a certain amount of mortgage fraud. And one case that I wrote about, which had been reported by Mike Van Sickler of the St. Petersburg Times, it hasn't been proven, but it was an apparent case of mortgage fraud where the buyer was essentially the seller was finding straw buyers and getting an overinflated appraisal and then selling it for wildly inflated amounts to people who had no intention of ever living there or ever making the mortgage payments. So that was obvious fraud. And the other case was simply speculation where people, you know, were flipping houses because property values were soaring. In Cleveland, how is anyone making money buying and selling houses? You profiled a couple who are who are speculators who have invested in a lot of property in Florida, in Cleveland. Who's buying from them?
Right. No, I mean, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think people like Tony Brancatelli thought the last bit of equity had been squeezed out of these houses. And Cleveland had the same kind of, you know, the kind of predatory, the kind of flipping that you write of, especially in the first instance where people would come in and buy houses and very quickly sell them at an inflated price with, you know, in cohorts with an appraiser. But you're right. So they've got this now. This what Brancatelli calls a second tsunami. You know, this wave of churning that's going on. These wholesalers who come in and buy up these properties in bulk because they're so cheap, and they're able to buy them so cheap and turn around and sell them for a profit. You know, maybe not much, maybe $10,000-$15,000. But when you got 100 properties, it adds up.
Yeah, I sort of had the feeling that if they could just sell one or two, they would have their money back because they were buying them so cheap.
Right, and that's
exactly
precisely what's happening.
And well, I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, well, I mean, what has people like Tony Brancatelli so concerned is a lot of these folks are coming in, buying up these vacant and vandalized houses, buying them cheap, not putting any money into repairs, and just simply selling them as is.
Well, in Florida now, you write, George, about this flipping going on, this predatory buying and selling going on as part of money laundering for drug dealers.
Yeah, there is this one case. It hasn't been proven in court, but the circumstantial evidence looks like mortgage fraud. It's a guy named Sonny Kim who owns a tattoo parlor. And Mike Van Sickler's reporting discovered that, first of all, Mike and I took a little tour of the properties of Sonny Kim, and they're all dilapidated houses that in very tough, rundown parts of Tampa that look a bit like the neighborhoods of Cleveland that Alex wrote about. And so houses were selling for $300,000, and the buyers couldn't be found. And some of the buyers had records, records in drug dealing and other cases. So what does that tell you? It suggests at least that that this was a fraudulent transaction in which the seller, Sonny Kim, intended to make a profit off the flip, and the buyer never intended to live there and was an associate and got some sort of a fee from Sonny Kim. And Sonny Kim cleared $4 million over a period of about 6 years, so it's a pretty lucrative business.
Not bad for a tattoo parlor owner.
I'm kind of curious, because what was interesting to me in Cleveland were two things. One is how few people had been prosecuted for mortgage fraud, and yet it was clearly so widespread. And the other part about it is that it was clear with all this mortgage fraud was taking place, but it was facilitated by all these, you know, brokerage houses that sprung up in the early 2000s. You know, they were out of state. They knew nothing about, let's say, Cleveland, for instance. So somebody could go to them and say, you know, I've got a house. It's worth $50,000. You know, would you, you know, provide a mortgage to this new buyer? And so it was kind of all these people who were kind of opportunistic, who took advantage of this kind of really ripe situation.
Yeah, I think that's exactly what happened in Florida. I mean, Mike Van Sickler and I stood outside a house that, you know, the siding was falling off. There were mattresses in the yard. And this house had sold for $300,000. And he said to me, I just don't think the banks did a drive-by to see whether this was worth the amount that they were going to be loaning. But you're right. In this sense, this is a problem that began at the top, not the bottom. It did not begin with imprudent or unwise or even greedy home buyers. It began with lenders who lost all their sense of caution because it was such a lucrative business. And it began with politicians and regulators who fell down on the job. I mean, in Florida, there were 10,000 convicted criminals in the mortgage business in the 2000s. And this is a state in which felons are unable to vote, at least until recently, but you could be a mortgage broker.
Right.
So there was a complete lack of regulation, which Florida is now paying the price for. And I think that there was an article in the Times yesterday about a new move among federal prosecutors to start cracking down. But it's a bit, you know, the horses have left the barn.
Right. Right. No, it's similar in Cleveland. I mean, back as early as 2001, Cleveland, Toledo, and there's one other city in Ohio, it escapes me at the moment, all passed anti-predatory ordinances. And then the banking lobby went to the state legislature and basically got the legislature to say we won't allow cities to pass anti-predatory ordinances. I mean, it was just wide open. I mean, I think you used the term. It was like the Wild West.
This is WNYC in New York. I'm Carrie Nolan in for Leonard Lopez today, and we're talking about the foreclosure crisis that is sweeping the country in many locations. We're talking specifically about Cleveland. Alex Kotlowitz's cover story, All Boarded Up, was in the New York Times Magazine this past Sunday, and George Packer wrote for the February 9th issue of The New Yorker about what's going on in Florida in an article called The Ponzi State. George, you write that it's that we have met the enemy and he is us, essentially.
Well, that was something that a lumberyard owner in Naples, Florida, who has seen his business just dwindle from booming to anemic, said to me. And he was saying essentially, how could I not keep selling lumber to contractors who kept getting contracts to build or renovate houses? I mean, in a sense, it caught all of us up in it. And I think in one aspect, that is true. Everyone is responsible for the decisions they make, and a lot of people made a lot of irresponsible decisions, including taking out mortgages that were at 10 times one's income. On the other hand, that is a little too easy on people with great power and great responsibility, and I think the people with more knowledge and more power bear a larger share of the burden of responsibility than the bank teller who was told by a lender that sure this loan is just right for you. And in that sense, the failure of oversight and regulation and the greed and short-term thinking of the lenders is really at the heart of this problem. There would not have been a Sonny Kim flipping properties in inner-city Tampa if there hadn't been a Bank of America, a Wachovia, a Wells Fargo, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and others, the whole lineup of famous and infamous financial institutions, to lend him the money to do it.
Alex, you write about Cleveland's rat court working to save that city's housing stock. What is a rat court?
Right. Well, you know, Cleveland has a loan housing court. It's the lowest rung of all the courts, and that's how the judges refer to it, as the rat court. And,
okay.
And what it does is it really prosecutes code violations. You know, it used to be in the best of times, you know, if somebody had a roof that was sagging or a porch that was leaning or windows that were broken, they'd be brought in there, cited for code violations, and the judge can fine them. He could even jail them in that court. And the judge there, Judge Pianca, I mean, he quickly, and you know, a few years ago, began to see things change dramatically in his court. And what he was seeing is that the kind of new land barons in Cleveland were these banks and lenders. I mean, they were kind of, I think, unwitting land barons. I mean, it wasn't what they intended, but they've ended up owning the bulk of these vacant and abandoned houses. And so the challenge for the city, the challenge for Judge Pianca, is holding these banks and lenders accountable for these houses. And that's been really tough. And one of the things that happened very early on, a bank would be cited, for instance, for code violations on an abandoned property, and they wouldn't come into court. They just kind of thumb their noses at it. You know, they'd say, I don't need to go there. And so the judge, to his credit, found an old statute from 1953 that allowed for what he thought allowed for trials in absentia. And every Monday, they would hold trials. There would be the prosecutor, there would be the judge, and there would be no defendant. And they would hold a trial, and he would end up usually fining the banks or the wholesalers, if that was who was in question. And then in some cases, he had to go and sweep their bank accounts to get the money. Now, just last month, Washington Mutual, which had been brought in for code violations on a house, didn't show up in court. Judge fined him. They've appealed. The appellate courts have ruled now that Judge Bianco cannot hold these trials in absentia, and so he's trying to figure out what to do next. It was interesting, when I called Chase, which now owns Washington Mutual, and asked them whether they would show up in court, they were just quite frank about it and just said, you know, we have no intention now of showing up in court. And so Judge Bianco is trying to figure out what he'd like to do, frankly, is have the city cite corporate officers, because then he can go out and subpoena them and arrest them if need be.
Let me ask both of you this question in the time that we have left. Did you find a kind of a common thread among the people who are sticking it out in these abandoned areas?
Well, in Florida, there isn't the same attachment to community in a new subdivision. I mean, anyone who lives in, you know, Tanglewood Estates in eastern Hillsborough County has lived there at most for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. So it's not as though people feel a sentimental attachment to the house they grew up in.
Right.
I met a woman in Tanglewood Estates named Tanglewood Preserve named Angie Harris, and she has 5 kids. Her husband's overseas in Bahrain. She's living alone with the kids. And she's not just living alone in her house. She's almost living alone in Tanglewood Preserve, because this is one of the subdivisions that actually got stopped before it was completed because of the bust caught it mid-construction. And her house is surrounded by vast open fields with a few street signs and even some asphalted streets, but very few houses mm-hmm. because it just didn't get finished. Well, she told me that there's almost a division in Tanglewood Preserve between those who bought in 2005 and 2006 and paid a lot more, and people like her who bought in the past year and might have paid $100,000 less for the same house. So it's not as though this is a tightly knit community that's banding together to stick it out. Instead, it's a bunch of strangers who all come from somewhere else
right.
and who hold against each other the fact that one of them might have paid half the same amount of money for the same house.
What about in Cleveland?
You know, I think George is right to draw that distinction, because in Cleveland there are these long and, you know, the people have lived in these communities for many, many years. And I remember I met one gentleman with the name James Brown, an easy name to remember. And when I met him, he was standing outside his house, and he was actually putting steel doors on because the house next to him was vacant and there were squatters in and out. But he'd be damned if he was moving from there. He'd bought that house 40 years ago with his wife. It's what he dreamed of. He actually had moved up from Florida and came to Cleveland back then when the steel mills were going strong. But the other problem, of course, for people in Cleveland is there, and I suspect as the case in Florida, is there's nobody to sell to. I mean, even
right.
if people wanted to leave, they really don't have that option at the moment.
You know, it's interesting. A lot of the people in that part of Florida came from the Clevelands of the country, from Ohio, Illinois, and Michigan, and they preserved a kind of conscience of having come from a place where values were deeper and better, and Florida seemed to be dissolving them. And so the Midwest to them represented the good old values that they've lost in Florida.
And unfortunately, that's where we have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you so much, Alex Kotlowitz and George Packer. Thank you so much for being with us. This conversation could definitely continue for a lot longer. This is WNYC New York. I'm Carrie Nolan, in for Leonard Lopate.